Welcome to this hour of In Deep. I'm Angie Cairo. Americans with a very clever, strong president once pulled themselves out of a desperate economic hole, and they did it with public works programs and conservation schools and an ethic that valued work and education. The schools they built are falling apart. The education inside them is worth less and less. This hour, we talk with scholar and commentator Gray Brecken on In Deep. Stay tuned for that very deep conversation. Ah, the heralds are out. Or the heralds are in. Anyway, the heralds are with us. It's In Deep with Angie Cairo. And it's that time again where we... Ouch! There's Buttercup landing on her... What did you just land on there?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm raw. Get it?
Oh, I get it. Laffy refers to... Yes?
I just hope I'm not late because I was busy posthumously turning Mormons gay.
Laffy, as per usual, has brought us her favorite headlines of the week, and we're going to slide into that. Her reference to Raw, by the way, is our new feature that is only on the internet, indeepradio.com, where you get to hear Laffy's and my entire conversation, warts and all, as we record this bit of frivolous joy every day. None too frivolous on this Mormon church thing. This really pissed me off. Go ahead and give us the headline here.
Yeah, it really pissed me off, too. Well, the Mormon Church has been posthumously baptizing people right and left, people who don't know that they're, you know, their families don't know they've been baptized, and among them, President Obama's mother, the parents of the late Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal, nearly baptized three dead relatives of Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel.
Oh, God.
And Anne Frank more than once. Okay, so now the latest, this one really pissed me off because we went to the same high school and I feel kind of a kinship with this guy, Daniel Pearl, who was kidnapped and executed in 2002 by terrorists. And so the wound is still very fresh with his family. And the way his parents found out about this was the reporter from the Boston Globe told them. And it had happened actually last summer.
What a bunch of conceit. That's incredibly, and you know, when I first read this, I thought, you know, this level of conceit borders on sociopathy. To me, it does.
And again, it's pushing their religion on. You know, this is what's been bugging me lately. Oh, and by the way, the father was worried that people would think his son had converted. I mean, that's a big worry for somebody who's very religious. And, you know, nobody wants the memory of their loved one to be affected by something like this. It's just, it shows such a lack of respect. And it brings us right into, you know, what's been happening lately with religious groups trying to push their beliefs on us in terms of health care for women.
Oh, my goodness. We're going to have to keep you on for an hour this week, but we're not. Yeah. Gotta Laugh, by the way, for those of you not familiar, is one of the geniuses behind thepoliticalcarnival.net, and you can find that link on our site at indeepradio.com. Oh, let's do cheer this up and live up to your name, Gotta Laugh. What else do you got for us?
Okay, well, let's cheer it up a little bit. The guy that Dick Cheney shot in the face, Harry Whittington.
And why is that funny? But it is.
I love that. Yes. Anyway, it's the sixth anniversary of the shooting. Happy sixth anniversary, everybody. Aww. And he's celebrating by, well, as he puts it, with a ceremonial consumption of a quail snack.
That's brilliant.
Okay, that's just ewitude. All right, so here's the deal. He still has this, like, pellets all over him. He's got some pellets lodged in his heart, his gums, his hand, his forehead, and the bridge of his nose. And his big, you know, punchline to all this is his doctors say that his chest looks like New York City at night. Rimshot.
This is his x-ray. His x-ray.
So I looked up stuff. And other than Whittington apologizing to Cheney for having his family go through all this, I found an old clip of Jon Stewart. And his quote was something to the effect of, how powerful a guy do you have to be when the guy you shot says to you, my bad?
Astounding. But now he's had 6 years of being a punchline. I guess there's some small benefit to him in this. So,
yeah, well, heartless dick, you know?
Well, we're squeezing a laugh in between two very ugly stories. Give me your other ugly story and let's get it the hell over with.
Okay, I hate this one. There's at a Virginia Metro station, and by the way, the Virginia Metros go through Washington D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. There's an ad up by a filmmaker of a film called Sick and Sicker that criticizes Obama's Affordable Care Act, and in this ad is prominently displayed black words on a white background, "Go to hell, Barack."
Yeah. What an appropriate way to honor the President of the United States.
Exactly. Let's respect the office. Okay. Now, what if this had been Bush or the Pope? You know, would they be celebrating the same kind of language? Meantime, the WMATA says the ad has been ruled by the courts as a public forum protected by the First Amendment, and they cannot decline ads based on their political content, to which Representative Jim Moran of Virginia, a Democrat, said, this isn't really political, it's profane, it's defamatory, and it coarsens the public discourse. So the filmmaker answers, quote, it was designed to express the magnitude of anger over our move towards socialized medicine. I'm extremely upset the government is going to take over healthcare. I'm not mildly upset. I'm extremely upset. And he complains because, see, he can't afford to spend a ton of money on ads like Michael Moore. So this is how he does it.
Oh, yeah, there's so much money on the left. All the money's on the left.
Oh, yeah, we have so much. I'm rolling it. Are you rolling in it?
I am rolling in it. Well, you know what? You brought us to the end of the segment, and I'm really glad because I can't stand to hear anymore. Gotta laugh. Thank you. And we'll see you back in your same comfy little slot next week.
Okay, thanks.
Gotta Laugh writes for The Political Carnival at thepoliticalcarnival.net, and you can hear this and more at indeepradio.com. That's where you're going to find the raw tapes of Angie and Gotta Laugh doing In Deep with Gotta Laugh. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. In our last hour, and I hope you caught that, we talked with linguist and radio commentator Jeff Nunberg about the use of language on the campaign trail and in the assault on education. Now, originally, my next guest was going to be part of that hour, and I was thrilled to find out he, in fact, had a whole hour to spend with us, because scholar and author Gray Brecken's work winds into so many areas that we care about so deeply. Now, I'm not using the royal we here. I'm not the Queen of England. If you're listening to In Deep, it is pretty safe to assume that you care about money, power, history, the environment, and reverencing beauty. And he is all that. Gray Brecken, welcome to In Deep.
Thank you, Angie. I hope I can live up to that.
You have to now. And in case you have any doubts, Gray Brecken is actually known as an author, as an academic. One of his best-known books is Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. And he's also written Farewell, Promised Land, Waking from the California Dream. He's a visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and the founder and project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project. And I hope to hit on all of that in this hour, but I want to start where we left off on the topic about education. You're in academia, you're in the UC system, and yes. Once upon a time, the UC system was education for all at an affordable price. If you were a state resident, chances were you could get in there and achieve your educational dreams. And that's not true anymore. And given that as context for you personally, what does it feel like to you when you hear a Rick Santorum on the campaign trail denigrating higher education as something for snobs?
Well, it's just an indication of where the United States has arrived at, actually, that somebody can do that, and then we can actually be in a time in which our educators are attacked as even treasonous, if not totally evil. You know, any society that does this is committing suicide, and that's exactly what we're doing. So it doesn't surprise me when Rick Santorum does that. What saddens me, I guess, is that it was received with wild enthusiasm by his audience. That's amazing that we've arrived at a place like that. I mean, somebody like Rick Santorum or any of the other Republican candidates makes somebody like Barry Goldwater look absolutely moderate, if not liberal by comparison. So, you know, we've arrived at a place in which we are actually denigrating education and knowledge.
It strikes me as almost a rational place to land, though. I mean, Rick Santorum isn't tapping into something new. I mean, this was born, in my mind, I'd like to get your take on it, out of the whole slamming of latte liberals and the liberal elite, the educated elite. It almost seems like the culmination of a long-term campaign to somehow turn the act of learning more than you were born learning into something reprehensible.
Well, yes, it's a long tradition. Richard Hofstadter, the great historian, did a book called Anti-Intellectualism in American Thought, which traces it back, its roots back a long, long ways. But it's really been gathering steam in the last couple of decades. Aided by right-wing radio and television, right-wing media, I should say, particularly Fox News, and I say that advisedly, since it's not news at all, but the Rupert Murdoch news empire or media empire, the very idea that facts don't exist, that everything is opinion, and therefore everything is valid because it's all your point of view. And so that's where we've arrived at. And along with that comes the idea of that educated people are elitist, that they're snobs. The fact that, you know, a president could run on the platform that who would you rather have beer with? Or that I work from my gut rather than from my head. Mm-hmm. Well, frankly, when I want a president who works from his head, that is from knowledge and from facts.
Not you can go have a beer with your friends.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
That's not what the seat is there for.
No. You want somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. And we've arrived at a very, very dangerous place, in which emotion now is more important than knowledge, let alone wisdom. I want wisdom.
I see something of the internet at work in that. And I know there's a blame the internet mentality with a lot of things. I'm not doing that. But one thing I've noticed with the internet being so pervasive now and everyone allowed to get on and introduce themselves and speak for themselves and start a blog is that devaluing of fact-based opinion, the devaluing of actually knowing something. It seems as though all opinions are perceived as equally valid now, whether there's any learning behind them, whether there's a grasp of statistics or knowledge behind it. Everyone seems to feel that opinions deserve respect because someone is speaking them, be it a single blogger mm-hmm. who we don't know from Adam, or someone who's, you know, wearing a white coat and talking about climatology, even though he's a podiatrist.
Yes.
So
that's a really good point. And I've noticed that in the comments that, you know, follow articles or blog pieces now. There are people who are just wing nuts or just, you know, just writhing with rage about one thing and another. And it's all together. And, you know, it's made me appreciate the very difficult job now that I realize of being a letter to the editor, editor at a newspaper, because they have to read all of this bilge all the time and decide what gets through. And of course, there's problems with being a gatekeeper. I've written about that quite a bit. But on the other hand, you know, if everybody's opinion is equally valid, then you've really got a problem. In the Bay Area, we have a prime example in the so-called conservative editorial writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, Deborah Saunders, who's a leading advocate of climate change denial.
Mm-hmm.
Although the paper is running news articles which make it, I think, unequivocally clear that the predictions of the scientists are now coming true, that we have climate chaos. We're living in it, and it's getting worse all the time. Deborah Saunders never misses an opportunity to slam the scientists as know-it-all, would-be priests, you know, stuck-up people who have, you know, these opinions about what's happening. And really, I think that the Chronicle shares a good deal of blame, actually, because of running somebody like that, because it's quite clear now that climate change, climate chaos, I should say, is very real, and it's accelerating now. And it may well be too late to do anything about it at this point.
At that cheerful juncture, I will interject that we're talking to Gray Brecken. He's a visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and the founder of California's Living New Deal Project. Let me go. So I do want to get to your knowledge on the New Deal, because there are parallels, obviously, in what's happening economically now. Mm-hmm. You keep hearing this referred to as a recession. And even more comically, I keep hearing that we may go back into recession. I thought, pardon me, did I miss something?
Exactly.
But, you know, we are in a time of economic strife. And I look at the view of education today, and I wonder if back in the days before the New Deal came in, during the Depression, did people prioritizing the fact they were unemployed, prioritizing the fact they didn't know where their next meal or maybe some new clothes were coming from, did they likewise decide that education was very low on the priority list?
No, they did exactly the opposite. And I should say here that I'm talking about the Roosevelt administration, mm-hmm. because under President Hoover, there wasn't anything like what came on with the New Deal. They weren't building schools. The federal government wasn't aiding in building public schools. What struck me about the New Deal is their educational initiatives and the way that I took advantage of it when I started going to school in the 50s and 60s, that you had a situation, which was ostensibly much worse than the one we're living in now in the Great Depression. And what did they do? They built thousands of schools. They built entire college campuses. They built museums and public libraries. They sponsored art projects, theater, music, etc. They did exactly the opposite of what we are doing in times which are ostensibly not as bad as that. They built schools instead of building prisons because they felt that it was much better for a society and certainly a lot cheaper to uplift people rather than to punish them and push them down. And it worked. It worked very, very well because they were, I mean, there was an ulterior motive. They wanted to have a stable society. They wanted to have a democracy, a working democracy. And you can't have democracy without having a large, well-educated populace who constitute its citizens. If you have widespread ignorance instead, which is what we're getting to now, what you have instead of democracy is demagoguery, mm-hmm. and something perhaps far worse than that. And that's where we're headed for right now. So what they did was they built beautiful schools, many of which have inscriptions on them. I study those inscriptions, and the inscriptions are all about uplifting, about how you can be better than you are through public education. One of my favorite schools is the one that they built for Hollywood, Hollywood High School, and it has inscriptions in English, Latin, and Greek. And the idea of that was that you didn't have to go to Groton or Exeter or anything. You could actually get that kind of a classical education in a public high school. You could learn the classics, history, English, everything was available to you through a public education. Well, you can't take that for granted anymore.
Was that availability of a good public education, was that at the time, was that true regardless of your color, regardless of your class, regardless of your economic stature?
Well, it depended where you were at that time. Certainly it wasn't true in the South, where the schools were still segregated at that time. And I would say around the rest of the country, probably the schools were probably pretty segregated anyway, by region. It wasn't available to everybody. But they're building it up. And one of the things I found from looking at the photographs is that at least in California, for example, the kindergartens were integrated at that time. And I think that the idea was that there would be a gradual process of integrating the races together because they couldn't do it suddenly. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting part of it. I wanted to point out another case, though, and that is the Morrill Act, which created our state universities around the country. That wasn't passed during a prosperous period. That was done during the Civil War. And Lincoln and the visionary congressman who passed that understood that this was an investment in America's future, and they passed that during the Civil War, and that resulted in our great public system of higher education, which grew into our state universities.
Got a lot more to talk about with Gray Brecken, who's visiting us here. We're going to move on beyond the education subject and talk about economics in general, both during the New Deal and now. The New Deal has been painted in some vastly different colors as time has passed, depending on your time. Very unflattering tones. And we'll be taking a look at some of that retrospective thought on the New Deal as well. And we hope to squeeze in a conversation, too, on some of the New Deal project buildings, murals, and other pieces of beauty around the country. All of that still to come here on In Deep. Stick around. I'm Angie Cuero.
Okay, but you gotta sing. You who were on the road must have a code that you can live by.
On the four, and so they got it.
Become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach.
Hold it.
Listen. You can't clap if you can't carry the beat, so you gotta not clap, okay? I know that you're moved, but you gotta be moved in time.
All right, one more time.
Pick it up where you left it off.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye.
Now sing.
Teach your children well, their father's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they fix, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why.
Welcome back to In Deep. If you miss any of our conversations, and in fact, for some conversational and written extras, I urge you to go to indeepradio.com. We have a lot there that we don't have time to put on the air. We're going to talk as much as we can this hour to Gray Brecken. He is the project scholar of California's Living New Deal Project, and he teaches at UC Berkeley in the Department of Geography, and he's the author of Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. Let's talk a little bit more about the education. When we left off, we were talking about the emergence of systems around the country where people could get accessible education. Here in California, and I don't expect our listeners in New York or Washington to get this whole story, but here in California, there's a very big, very visible fight over trying to make education accessible again, trying to bring the salaries of the people who run the schools in line with the realistic budgets that they have, maybe de-emphasizing football stadiums in favor of laboratories. Do you see any future in which we might go back to that accessibility of education for the average person?
Frankly, I don't. I wish I did, but I don't, because the students are calling for it. But remember, the students don't, they're young and they don't have any experience with having a quality free education like I did. I'm 64 years old now, and I came to UC Berkeley because I couldn't afford anything else. It was free at the time that I came in 67. And so I came because I was a resident of California, and I took that for granted as my birthright. I didn't even think about it. I'm ashamed of that now. And that actually was a lingering remnant of the New Deal, that education is a human right, that you can't have a democracy without good public education. And so I inherited that, and I never thought anything about it. Well, I think about it a great deal now because the students whom I talk to, one of the the foremost thing that's on their mind is how much they're working to get themselves through college and how much debt they're building up anyway. You know, it's heartbreaking for me because not only are they paying a great deal more than I paid, but they're getting far less at the same time. It's really a business model. You know, they're paying a lot and they're getting a lot less for it. It's quite deliberate.
It's funny that you said in our earlier segment when you were talking about the way that these things came into being and how the schools were being subsidized during the New Deal and schools were being built and they were prioritizing schools over prisons. One of the things that occurred to me is the profit motive. Nowadays, prisons are a profit center.
Yes.
So there are more and they're privatized.
So are schools. Mm-hmm.
Schools are being privatized. Mm-hmm. Right. There's more money to come in there. And ironically, the party of money, the right and the people who hold most of the economic strings, they don't seem to be in favor of a good education, although they could profit off them. You know, they do profit off them. And at the same time, they're working hard to cut the legs out from under education societally, to de-emphasize it, to denigrate it. Mm-hmm. It seems as though they kind of win either way. For the people who buy into needing education, they'll get the profit. And for those that they can dissuade from education, my opinion, they're easier to lead if they're more ignorant.
Absolutely. And as I said, this is quite deliberate. Milton Friedman, the god of the far right economics field, wrote a paper, a position paper for the Libertarian Cato Institute in 1995, in which he laid out what's actually happened. He said that basically we have to privatize public education and turn it into, essentially, we privatize it. He didn't say that it's going to be profit producing, but that was the idea. And he admitted in that paper, he said, this is a radical proposal, so it can't be done suddenly. It has to be done gradually. And that's what's happened. The Cato Institute and the various other right-wing think tanks essentially got this message out in a variety of ways, but they were helped by the whole philosophy of starve the beast, that is, starve the government of the funding that it needs for a public sector. And then you can say, well, there is no alternative. We're really sorry we have to privatize public education and commercialize it, but really we have no alternative.
Because we've made it so bad now.
Yes. Uh-huh. And, you know, also the administrators that have been put in place of a great institution like the University of California are, as a whole, not professional educators. They are professional administrators now with very little commitment to public education. And so, and they're working for, such as the regents, you know. The regents of the University of California, none of them have any experience in education or commitment to it, really. It's a point of prestige and a political plum. They are generally very wealthy businessmen and women, and they see education in a particular way. It's a potential profit center. So that, and as colleges become, I should say, there's a whole profitable sector now, the for-profit colleges, in which, for example, Regent Richard Blum is heavily invested. And it's very, very profitable because the students take out loans, which are government insured, and there's a very high default rate. So you can actually make a great deal of money in for-profit colleges. So the more that you undercut the public education system, the more students will be encouraged to go over towards the for-profit system. Also, a number of the regents or trustees of our public universities are bankers. And of course, they get it by loaning out money to students who will then have to pay it back with interest. So there's a built-in conflict of interest going on. And I think this is one of the things that is propelling this system, ever-rising tuition. It is to the advantage of those who run higher education to keep it going up. And there's one other thing, too, in that the student, the ability to raise student tuition can be used as equity on Wall Street so that you can then sell bonds to pay for new buildings and, for example, sports stadiums and other such things by using the student tuition as equity. Wall Street just loves this. Now, the problem with that is that student debt is now, it's the next bubble because it just passed $1 trillion, student debt. And the students can't pay that off.
Right.
Because many of them are graduating, they can't find work. And so I think this is the next bubble to pop. It's going to be student debt. And it could be very, very messy.
In fact, I saw two statistics along that line just this past week. One is what a huge difference it would make to the American standard of living if you could forgive student debt right now. Just forgive the student debt, get these kids out from under that heavy blanket, and let whatever number of them could go find work to go find work and start being participating, start putting their money back into the system by becoming consumers. I mean, that would even have an appeal to a consumer happy motivated mind.
I would think so, yes.
But there's that. And then, of course, the other statistic I saw was that of the younger people, you know, about 54% can find a job right now. So
yes,
nearly half cannot find work, even if they're looking.
They're moving back in with their parents if they got parents who have a house or something large enough to move back into. You know, I mean, I feel for these kids. I mean, you know, they're graduating. When I graduated, there were lots of jobs. You just expected. I mean, the university was the way you advanced yourself, and then, of course, you got out and got a job. What do you do when you graduate and there's nothing for you to do with your degree?
Talking to researcher and scholar Gray Brecken of the University of California at Berkeley, and I can't imagine they're thrilled with what you say out loud a lot of times.
Oh, they're not thrilled at all. No. Because I'm pointing out, you know, what's happening to a once great institution. And I've been a critic of the university, but I also love it desperately because it's what I've gotten all my degrees from. I've never been able to leave Berkeley from the time I came here as an undergraduate. I love this place. And it's absolutely heartbreaking to watch what's happening to it and to the other campuses as well, too, as they begin shuttering and selling off some of the great research libraries for which UC was once famous.
It's heartening to me, though, maybe I'm naively optimistic, mm-hmm, the protests that I've been seeing at the UC system, at other state systems, protests in general, the Occupy, et cetera, I had been laboring under the really unpleasant delusion that the coming generations really couldn't care less about politics, not when there's, you know, Zynga to play, not when you can be doing Farmville, not when you can be doing, you know, World of Warcraft, then why bother with who's in office? And I see a resurgence of that spirit, and not people who are naively running out for a fun night of shattering windows. I'm hearing intelligent, informed, determined words from this generation coming up, where they're demanding that this change, that this is not right. They see that it's not right, and they're willing to quit their jobs and go occupy a campus.
Yes. Well, there is that, but at the same time, the administration is cracking down on them. So we've had a number of instances of just brutality when the students have been met with brutality from the administration and the campus police. The most recent one being at Berkeley, being on November 9th, in which not only the students, but even the professors who were trying to protect the students were brutally beaten by the campus cops. And then, of course, there's a notorious incident of the nonviolent students at Davis being drenched in pepper spray, and then students at UC Riverside being shot with plastic bullets. The students are getting an education that I got back during the time of the People's Park and anti-Vietnam riots. But it's an education I wish they weren't getting. But perhaps it's necessary.
It's ironic to think that some of the people that are in the Cato Institute and the positions of power and the bankers, a lot of them are the product of the age of Vietnam. They came up through the protest years. Some of them, God forbid, may even have been seen in the Haight-Ashbury back in the day.
Yes.
And now they're in positions of power, and where did all that go?
I know.
I knew this would happen. I brought you in to talk about the New Deal, and I knew we'd go all over the place.
Uh-huh.
But let me stay with that for just a moment. Are there vestiges of the freedom days of the original hippies and the original protests at UC Berkeley? I mean, was that ultimately worth it?
That's a great question. I don't know. Some has been written actually about how the excesses of the 60s, of the time that I lived through, in fact, led to a sort of counter-revolution, a whip back in the sense of the increasingly conservative and then essentially extreme right-wing movement that we have. And there's actually truth to that because Lewis Powell, it was Lewis Powell in 1971 wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because he was very alarmed, and those of his class were very alarmed at the student uprisings at that time, and they wanted to make sure this would never happen again. He was a very conservative lawyer, and he wrote this memo, and he laid out the plan for how we would essentially change language, change the way that people think so that the kind of student activism of the 1960s would not happen again. And that's largely been implemented. And soon after he did that, President Nixon nominated him to the U.S. Supreme Court. So he had a position of great power. But the Lewis Powell memo is a very important document, like the Milton Friedman memo of 1995, which lays out how to privatize the nation's public schools. These things, as I say, don't happen accidentally, but they don't happen out in full view either. You have to really do some research to find out how these programs were implemented over time. And as I said, Friedman recognized that this was a radical program, and so it would have to be implemented slowly, and slowly by changing the way that people think. So that's, I think, how we've arrived at a position where we now denigrate and actually, calumniate, scathingly criticize our educators. As I said at the beginning of the show, this is national suicide when you do something like that.
Gray Brecken is my guest. If you're looking him up online, he spells his name Brechin. I'm Angie Coiro, and you're listening to In Deep. Let's do reflect on the New Deal and how it's viewed through a modern lens. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up in Catholic school. There's no way you can tell me I had a liberal education. There was nothing of the sort. And I learned about the New Deal with a great deal of wonder and respect. It was taught as something that looked at a vastly complicated problem with many tentacles and methodically began attacking that in ways that energized the nation, that corralled its resources and put them to work, and brought some money back into the system, and still has vestiges all around the country today. It surprised me the very first time I heard anyone say, you know, the New Deal didn't work. The New Deal kind of sat there and held a space until the war brought money back into American pockets. And it also was a bad thing because of XYZ. And there are any number of XYZs for this.
Yes.
But in short, there are a lot of people now who believe that the New Deal either was a good idea that really didn't work or wasn't that good of an idea to begin with.
Yes. Well, this is part of the whole campaign of changing people's thought by repeating the big lie over and over again. And you've heard it many, many times. Everybody knows the New Deal didn't end the Depression. The war did. Well, that's not true. You know, I've studied it quite a bit. And if you can just see the charts of the GDP, and you see that it begins rising sharply from the time that Roosevelt comes in and begins instituting the New Deal. It pauses in 1937 because things were good enough at that time that Roosevelt starts turning off the tap. But he did so prematurely. The economy hadn't recovered. And it plunges into a deep recession until he turns the tap back on again. And then it continues on its way up. So the country was out of the Great Depression by the time of Pearl Harbor. And it was largely because of these huge public works programs that were instituted at that time, which pumped money into the economy both from above and, but more importantly, from below by giving people money. I mean, the WPA and the CCC workers were paid directly by the federal government, and that mainlined the economy and got it going again. But at the same time, it built up a tremendous public infrastructure, which is not only why we won the war so fast, because they prepared for that, but it also laid the groundwork for the great prosperity of the 1950s. But then we forgot about it. Even at the time, they weren't really aware that they were standing on the shoulders of the work that had been done during the Great Depression. And we've taken it for granted and actually forgotten about it. I think of it as a lost civilization that we're trying to uncover now. And it's the most amazing thing when you start uncovering it, to think that my parents built this.
Maybe unfair to ask you this right up against a break, but in brief, when we hear these programs described as socialism, I don't want to go blanket yes or no. Are there elements of this that can, in fact, be described as akin to a socialist program? And what are your thoughts if it is?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, Roosevelt was trying to save capitalism from itself. And he realized that you had to take pressure off of the system or it would destroy itself. And so he did that. But the government never owned the means of production. It didn't go that far. It simply paid people to do socially beneficial work. It wasn't socialism by any means. It was a kind of social democracy, a bit more like what European countries have now, but they're capitalist. But they just provide a social safety net for their people, which we're losing here in this country.
Gray Brecken's work can be found online at graybrecken.net. That's B-R-E-C-H-I-N. You are listening to In Deep, and I hope you continue to do so, because it turns out we will have time to discuss some of these still with us New Deal buildings and murals and public works and the efforts to save them. And some of them are just things of beauty, absolute things of beauty. We'll talk about that as we continue on In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro.
Roosevelt, you're the hero of the hour. We sent you on to Washington, bestowed on you full power. This country is a vast domain, its finest spot on earth. We've worked and struggled, fought and won every conflict since our birth. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again and singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you 120 million strong.
So cut expense, tear down the fence between supply and demand. Put folks to work, don't let them shirk, let farmers keep their land. They don't need cash to cut a dash, there's faith in those we trust. So when they say that they will pay, they will not go and bust. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt will need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long. Tell folks how happy once again is singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you, 120 million strong. So onward, noble president, we pledge our faith in you. 'Cause when we see your smiling face, we never can be blue. So smile and pray, work hard each day, and soon things will be bright. The sun will shine, we'll all be fine, everything will be all right. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long. Tell folks how happy once again is singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you, 120 million strong. Let's look into the future now, many years from today. There'll be another president to help us find our way.
Welcome back to In Deep. We have one more segment with Gray Brecken, who's here from, well, down the street at UC Berkeley. He's with their Department of Geography. Yeah, that always sounds so odd to me to say you're with the Department of Geography. Because I know that you study, you know, the architects and the New Deal buildings and all of that, but I guess when I think of geography, I think of maps.
Well, most people do, but I mean, get with it. no, the reason I went into geography is because I'm a generalist, and geography is the last generalist field. You can study pretty much anything as long as it has to do with humans and the earth and how they interact together. And my department's fascinating because of the breadth of things that people study in it. I never get tired of being there.
It's great. Well, I'll put that on the list of things I need to get with it. Okay. I'm still on computers. California's Living New Deal project and the efforts to, in fact, this goes on around the country to some extent, is the effort to take a look at what we have left of the New Deal and make sure we keep it restored. And is it true that we're talking about both buildings and ideas?
Oh, absolutely. Because you can't talk about one without the other. I mean, I've been studying this now. And by the way, it's not California's Living New Deal. We've gone national. We located at least 1,000 New Deal public work sites in California, and we're not finished. We'll never get to the bottom of it. There's so much of it because we scarcely touch what the Civilian Conservation Corps did for us. But last summer, we decided we would go national because we want people around the country to know, well, to see a different America. We want them to see New Deal America, and it's like developing a photograph, you know, it's just sort of swimming out of the developer and you see, oh my God, they did this. This stuff is all around us. We're using it all the time. And it's so exciting to do that because so much of it is so beautiful, and so much of it is so essential. Like public health, for example, because when the New Deal started in 1933, a minority of Americans had safe drinking water, and 6 years later, virtually everybody did. And we've been taking it for granted ever since then. But that's thanks to the New Deal.
What did that involve? We're talking new filtering systems, new ways to clean a whole city's worth of water?
It was everything. It was building dams, canals, conduits. But above all, it was providing adequate sewage systems. So, for example, Chicago was drinking its own sewage until the Public Works Administration came in and totally rebuilt the system underground while the city was operating above it. It was the largest such project in the world at that time. And Chicagoans have been taking it for granted ever since, but that was a gift of the New Deal. But it seems almost every town and city that I've studied, particularly the small towns in the Central Valley in California, they got sewage systems and almost immediately forgot that. So
it's the new reality. Once it's real to you, you don't think about what used to be.
That's right. You know, they would have a dedication ceremony and almost immediately they'd take it for granted and forget about it. And that's what we've done with our school system, for example. We took all that for granted. These schools are now 75, 80 years old, and we just take them for granted. But we shouldn't, like free education, you know, that I took for granted. So the ideas and the buildings and the infrastructure, they're all of a piece. And for about the 7 or 8 years that I've been studying this, I was looking for, well, what am I going to write about that hasn't been said about the New Deal? And what I'm going to write about is what I call the lost ethical language of New Deal public works, because there was an ethos or an ethics to this. And that is that the common people count, and that government can help them, and its proper role is to help them to achieve a democracy. And a large part of that is by making universal quality education available to everybody. And so that's one of the things I'm interested in. I'm interested in the inscriptions on the buildings, such as the noblest motive is the public good. Or on Whittier Middle School in California, what you would have in a state, you must first put into its schools. And the person who said that was Wilhelm von Humboldt, who created the public school system for Germany in the 19th century, which is why Germany quickly became a world power, is because of its commitment to public education for everyone. And that's something we've forgotten. So we need to read those inscriptions and ponder what they mean or what they meant, because we're losing all of that.
You know, and I'm pondering, and I don't mean to make little of what you're saying, but as you were giving me some of those slogans, I was thinking the odd Ayn Randian who might have just come across this radio show, their heads were exploding just to even hear those slogans, because they're anathema to the kind of thinking that's out there with a lot of people now.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was thinking when I was preparing about 1984, the novel 1984, and you know, in the Ministry of Truth, one of the slogans is "War is peace," and we're there now. You know, that we have a Nobel laureate who won the Nobel Peace Prize, who basically gets standing ovations practically by promoting war. And but we're also at the position. Another one of the slogans of the Ministry of Truth was "Ignorance is strength," and we're there as well too.
Oh yeah.
When Rick Santorum can get wild applause by saying that college education is for snobs, and other people can openly attack educators and get cheers for that, we're in a very dangerous position. We're at the position where ignorance is strength. And, you know, and you can have a president that says, I don't work from my head, I work from my gut. And people love that. You know, no. You know, we're in a dangerous position where you can claim that ignorance is strength.
You know, we've made a couple literary references this hour. One of the ones that keeps coming back to me is the movie Quiz Show, which was based on the quiz show scandals of the 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
It could never happen today, because the way that this permeated the culture at the time, the whole nation was thrilled to watch this intellectual jousting happening every week. And it was, they depended on a breadth of knowledge. You had to know which Roman emperor came after who and who designed his outhouse. I mean, it just, it covered everything.
Yes, it was fascinating.
And for that kind of person to be hailed so highly that to find out he cheated would devastate the country?
Yes.
That's not going to happen.
Oh, no. No, you'll never see anything like that. No.
Yeah.
You know, I frankly don't watch television. And so in those few times that I'm traveling and I'm in a motel and I flip it on, I feel like somebody from Mars, you know, when I see this. I just can't believe what I'm watching, except my country committing suicide by having, you know, by allowing children to watch that, or let alone, or adults, you know, that, because it's just, well, Newton Minow famously called television a vast wasteland, but the television that he was talking about was Olympian compared with what we now have. And you're absolutely right. And that crosses the board. It includes public television now. I think of how in the 70s, the public station in San Francisco had something called Newsroom on prime time, in which they invited in journalists. And the journalists, for an hour, talked about the news. And it was fascinating, because these are really smart people with inside information. And people would come home early so that they could watch Newsroom and all. Well, what's on that slot right now? Antique Roadshow.
Oh.
You know, we've gotten rid of public education, we've filled the void with entertainment. And so we don't know what's missing, because the entertainment is so seductive. Now, and you don't realize what's missing. So what concerns me is once you've destroyed your public education system that took over a century to build up, but with a great deal of fighting, et cetera, how do you ever get it back? Because you don't know what's gone anymore. And I think that's where we've sort of arrived.
You're listening to Gray Brecken. His website is graybrecken.net. I'm very pleased to have him here from UC Berkeley with me for this hour. There's a billboard I saw on the way here. I do want to get back to our New Deal building.
Sure.
but you did tip me off. As I was driving to the studio today, I saw a billboard that said, "Never stop playing." And it was a cute little animated figure, as so many things are cute and animated now. And it occurred to me, because you and I were going to talk about this hour, I thought, you know, we kind of have to stop playing once in a while and be the grown-ups. And I'm worried that that's the attitude that's really, you know, you're right. It's reality shows. It's escapism. It's not realizing that there's work to be done. So, yes. So let's do go back to the New Deal.
Can I just say, one of my favorite WPA posters was for free adult education. And what you read on it in sort of Art Deco letters was, it's an adult world. Its problems are up to you.
That should be reissued.
Yes.
I would love to see that on billboards.
Yes, but you won't. What you will see is advertisements for diesel jeans that just say, "Be stupid." This is a prize-winning advertising campaign directed at teenagers. Be stupid.
Well, if you set the bar low enough, everybody can have high self-esteem.
That's right, and you can achieve it, too.
Well, you know, we hear a lot with today that because the tax situation is so bad, the economy is so bad, our infrastructure is falling apart. There are bridges that collapse while, unfortunately, vehicles are on them, and there are others cracking and threatening to do the same. What percentage of those are New Deal structures? I mean, is there a lot of crossover between what the New Deal did to improve public systems and what we're seeing fall apart now?
Well, the bridge that so famously collapsed in Minneapolis was not a New Deal bridge. That, I think, was built in the 1960s, which makes it all the more alarming that it was so much younger. Fortunately, the New Deal built very, very well. And so they've lasted for now about 80 years or so. But they can't last forever. They never anticipated that we would decide at some point that we weren't going to pay the taxes necessary to upkeep them, let alone expand those systems, which is why the American public infrastructure is now in such scandalous shape. The American Society of Civil Engineers grades American infrastructure with a D, and that includes our dams, many of which are not being inspected anymore. And so that's why the infrastructure is collapsing, because we've just decided we're not going to maintain it. Sort of reminds me of what happened to Rome, actually.
Ouch.
Yes, especially as their aqueducts began collapsing. You know, you couldn't maintain a city like Rome if they didn't have aqueducts anymore. And we're sort of getting to that position right now.
Is there anyone in positions of power, and I mean in the Obama administration, in any appointees, cabinet, anything, that you feel has a grasp of what's at stake with losing the New Deal infrastructure?
I don't see anybody. As a matter of fact, anybody who did have ideas like that, like his economics advisor, Christine Romer, they've left the administration or been forced out. The very idea that it's the role of the government to help everyone and in a crisis situation such as we're in now, to actually pay people to work, to do socially beneficial things like in the WPA or my favorite, the Civilian Conservation Corps. I don't hear anybody saying that at this point, certainly not the president. And we desperately need something like the CCC now. You have all these young men who now have no prospects when they get out of high school or college even, but particularly out of high school. They need to do something. And the CCC was the example because it helped young men who went in illiterate and came out literate, as well as having done things that made them proud and proud for the rest of their lives. We need something like that.
So the CCC combined schooling and work.
It did. Every camp, and they were about 200 people per camp, would have an educational facility. And they would also get extension from WPA. They would send out extension material so that the young men were educated while they were doing public service.
Again, I hear heads exploding, because as soon as you say Obama wants to put people in camps, you know.
Exactly. Well, that's the kind of camp I'd like to see them in. And they were specifically civilian. They were run by the military, but they were civilian. Men could leave them when they wanted to. And very few did, actually.
How do we compare compare in the situation then to now? We're looking at the same percentages of unemployed, roughly the same, worse, better?
No, it was higher at that time. The overall figure was 25%, but, you know, it varied around the country. In other places, it was much higher at that time. But that's true of now. You've got unemployment figures in the San Joaquin Valley that are higher than the average of the Great Depression at that time. So we need something desperately. We need something modeled on what was done during the Great Depression. And we need to learn how successful it was. So people can find out about that by going to my website, which is livingnewdeal.berkeley.edu. And you can learn a great deal, both about the buildings and about the ideas. But at the same time, if people know of New Deal sites in their community that we don't have, I urge them to contact us.
And, you know, we're going to put that link on our website.
Because please do.
I repeat our website so often, everybody knows it. So, indeepradio.com.
Great.
And that's livingnewdeal.berkeley.edu. We'll put that on our site so people can grab that. Well, let's talk about if we were to spin a wonderful tale and say there's a chance the New Deal could come back.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of arguments were there against it at the time that we could anticipate now and maybe cut off?
Well, the arguments of the time were very much like now, that it was a great waste of money, that the favorite pejorative of the people who hated Roosevelt and the New Deal was boondoggle. The idea that this was just a waste of money, that, you know, the men were in the WPA were raking leaves in the forest or just pushing brooms, that they were leaning on their shovels. Now, there's a Dorothea Lange photograph that I saw, and she worked for the Farm Securities Administration doing those great photographs for which she became so famous. It's of WPA workers walking down Market Street in 1939 protesting their low wages. One was carrying a sign that said, was the Cow Palace built leaning on shovels? I saw that and I thought, I didn't know the Cow Palace was a WPA project. Because it doesn't have any marker identifying it as such. It's this huge public gathering building in San Francisco, or just across the border. And it was a WPA project, like so many of the others around the country. But it doesn't have any marker. And this is one of the reasons that people have no idea.
That's what I was going to ask you, is that when you talk about discovering WPA projects, I guess I thought there was a comprehensive list somewhere.
No, it was never done because the war came on, and so all of the New Deal agencies were out of existence by 1943, so there was never anybody to do that. And then, of course, there was an opposition in the McCarthy period to the entire New Deal idea of communitarianism. And so it just vanished. So, as I said, we're digging up this lost civilization, which happens to be our own. And the thing that we're constantly amazed by is not only the magnitude of it, but the beauty of so much of it.
Well, that actually reminds me, and I want to encourage people to get on your mailing list, because your latest newsletter has a beautiful mural that was rediscovered. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, that was a mural back east. I mean, we're constantly rediscovering lost New Deal works of art that may have been covered up with a false wall or even painted over. And people are really beginning to appreciate that. Now, what I'm most concerned about is our public, our post offices, half of which are slated for closure in the next 5 years. And many of those have the only public artworks in many towns in the United States. It's going to be a great loss if that actually happens. And it's totally unnecessary.
So you need money, you need support to get that together.
Absolutely.
I hope this helps you do that.
I do too.
Greg Brecken is from the UC Berkeley, and we have all of his other details online at indeepradio.org. You can go to the website for him, livingnewdeal.berkeley.edu. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie. It's been fun.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you for tuning in to In Deep. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Matt Fidler is our engineer. Our theme music is by Big Troubles. David Gans provides our closing music. Visit us online at indeep.com for web-only extras from Gotta Laugh, Joshua Holland, Deborah Cooper, and more. Thanks to Peter James Callahan at We Act Radio in Washington and to Hal Ginsberg at KRXA in Monterey. We will be back next week to once again go In Deep. See you then.
With other people's private parts. They want us to do.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep, which is a production of Live from the Left Coast. You can get more information on the show and our company at lftlc.com. Live from the Left Coast. While you're there, you can become a member and support our work. We have a separate website for the show that is indeep.org. If you have any questions or feedback, there's a contact button right there, indeep.org. We are developing a recurring series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and you're a big part of that. We'd like your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions. Send them in via our website, the contact button at indeep.org. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coro. Thanks, and we will see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.